Thank you, John. I think the sermon is probably quite long anyway, so I will just start and hopefully that will reveal something about me. Christians now a minority for the first time. That was the headline in the Daily Telegraph on the 29th of November last year. It followed the publication of the 2021 census results, in which, for the first time, less than half of the population of England and Wales describe themselves as Christians. While we await the publications of the results in Scotland, it's unlikely to produce any different headlines. So what is behind the decline? Being a more discerning newspaper than the Telegraph, the Guardian newspaper looked into the census results and published a series of letters from readers on why they had given up their Christian faith. Take Diana, 44, a retail worker from Yorkshire. She was raised in a Christian home, but couldn't reconcile her Christian faith with the fact that our bodies are subject to disease, decay, and death. She wrote, "The final straw was watching my father die of cancer and trying to do so without pain relief, as it was God's will, while waiting to be healed. I finally admitted to myself that I didn't believe in a supernatural being and couldn't pretend anymore." Or listen to the words of James, a 44-year-old man from Birmingham who couldn't reconcile God's sovereignty with the harsh realities he faced. At some point in my late teens, the stuff that provided comfort, such as the idea of an omnipotent, omniscient God, suddenly started to feel more like a fairy tale you tell kids to help them sleep at night. And then I thought, if God knows exactly what I'm going to do and lets it happen, then I no longer have free will. As we turn to Psalm 139, a section of the Bible that gives us an almost unparalleled glimpse of the magnificence and majesty of God, there seems to be a reality gap between David's words and the everyday reality of our bodies and lives. Why is that? Good morning, everybody. As John said, my name is Michael Gilmartin, and I'm here this morning on behalf of the Edinburgh Preaching Group to continue your look at Psalm 139. Today, I want to look at two things in relation to the third stanza in verses 13 to 18. First, what exactly does David believe? And secondly, why does he believe it? So please look with me, if you will, at verses 13 to 18 of Psalm 139. I think it will be on the screen. Have you got it on the screen, Declan? Yeah. Perfect. Or it's in your... Is there a page in the Pew Bibles, John?
We have it. No, we don't. We're all on different Bibles.
Okay, all so different Bibles.
Please
right, hopefully I can read it clearly for you then.
Yes.
"For you created my inmost being. You knit me together in my mother's womb. I praise you because I'm fearfully and wonderfully made. Your works are wonderful. I know that full well. My frame was not hidden from you when I was made in the secret place, when I was woven together in the depths of the earth. Your eyes saw my unformed body. All the days ordained for me were written in your book before one of them came to be. How precious to me are your thoughts, God. How vast is the sum of them. Were I to count them, they would outnumber the grains of sand. When I awake, I am still with you." So, in our first section, we're going to look at what exactly David believes. And to do this, we need to dig into the text and look beneath the surface. Verses 13 to 16 bring out two of David's key beliefs. David believes that we are wonderfully and personally made by God. And David believes that our lives, our circumstances, are ordained or written by God. Now, I don't know about you, but there are days when I get up and look in the mirror and the reflection doesn't really look like something wonderfully made. And when I venture out of the bathroom into a living room with orange paint splattered all over the carpet, which has now been there for 3 years, and trample on the kids' Rice Krispies and cornflakes before tripping over a rainbow high doll, the last thing I think is that some almighty creator has written this chapter of my life before I was even conceived. Then I head into my office and I'm asked to advise on some procurement law question. I have no clue about procurement law, and then I head home on a number 44 bus in the dark, in the wind and the rain. The words of Psalm 139 couldn't be further from my mind, and that's me not even contemplating my hurts from the past and my fears for the future. So is the stuff we've read in Psalm 139 really true? Is it something I can depend on, or am I, in Diana's words, just pretending? Or am I, in James's words, brainwashed by some fairy tale and not facing the reality of my earthly existence? So let's look more closely into what David actually believes to see whether life for him is a bit of a fairy tale or if he's just deluded. So am I wonderfully made? According to David, absolutely. For you created my inmost being. You knit me together in my mother's womb. I praise you because I'm fearfully and wonderfully made. Your works are wonderful. I know that full well. Remember that these words are credited to David. And remember that David himself knew what it was like to be rejected by man for his physical being. When Samuel was told to pick David for the future kingship, God had to rebuke Samuel for judging David by his physical appearance. In 1 Samuel 16, verse 7, God is recorded as saying to Samuel, "Do not consider his appearance or his height, for I have rejected him, Saul. The Lord does not look at the things people look at. People look at the outward appearance, but the Lord looks at the heart." Later in David's life, recorded in 1 Samuel 17:42, Goliath inspects the shepherd boy who had happened on this mismatched battle between the Israelites and the Philistines, and who had the audacity to take him on when no one else would. He looked David over and saw that he was little more than a boy, glowing with health and handsome, and he despised him. Now, I might not mind being described as glowing with health and handsome, but in this time and in this context, this was a grotesque insult. Children were not taken seriously. David was nothing but a weakling, an insult to Goliath. How could he take on this giant, highly experienced and decorated warrior? David, though, had no regard for his lack of physical prowess, saying, "You come against me with sword, spear, and javelin, but I come against you in the name of the Lord Almighty." You see, God is not so much concerned with our outward attributes, our height, our beauty, our hair, or lack of it in my case, our physical strength. He looks at the real beauty of his creation, our innermost being, what we might call our heart. And in Christ, he sees the beauty. In David's words again, this time from Psalm 51, "A broken and contrite heart, you, God, will not despise." To be wonderfully made is not to have a brilliant brain and a beautiful body. We are beautiful no matter the disease and decay, because it's God who has made us. Our beauty comes from our Maker. We are made in his image, albeit we're a highly tarnished image. In the absence of a miraculous healing, Diana lost her faith when her father died. As a result, she couldn't believe we are wonderfully made. That, though, is not the message of Psalm 139. And as always, we have to find our context in the wider message of the Bible and indeed the gospel. Diana's faith, or more likely absence of faith, was conditional on prosperity. Verses 14 and 15 of Psalm 139 are not about our physical beauty or prowess. Our bodies are subject to disease and decay, and sometimes, especially when we're getting older, it's difficult to find the beauty. This is confirmed by the Apostle Paul in his second letter to the Corinthians. It begs us to find joy in our faith in God, no matter what our bodies go through. He says, therefore we do not lose heart, though outwardly we are wasting away, yet inwardly we are being renewed day by day. Sometimes hard to believe that. God does not exempt us from the realities of this earthly life, and he will not accept any conditions on which we base our faith in him. It must be without condition. Otherwise, we are making ourselves God and God our servant. David knows this. So on to the second part of the first section, and on to the second half of verse 16, where David tells us, all the days ordained for me were written in your book before one of them came to be. David knows that God knows everything that has happened to him. He also knows that God knows that everything that will come to pass was ordained, or in our language, commanded by God. God knows everything before it happens. And that's not surprising when you consider the science of it. Our universe is essentially a fabric made up of space and time. Time is therefore a creation itself, and any creator could not be subject to it. By definition, any creator must be eternal. And the science fits with what we know of God from the Bible. In Deuteronomy 33, it said, the eternal God is thy refuge, and underneath are his everlasting arms. So what are we to make of this if we're not satisfied with the circumstances that God has given us? What if our lives are out of control? What if we cannot get rid of the hurts of the past? And what if we cannot contain our worries about the future? That might lead to a conclusion similar to that of James of Birmingham. How, therefore, could David possibly believe that God is still in control? Did David just have a good set of circumstances and could be grateful to God for that? He is a king after all, and I would think the closest anyone here got to yesterday's coronation was through a TV screen. Again, we have to look beneath the surface to see what David actually believes. After all, David was no stranger to terror, to depression, and to anxiety. They are scattered throughout the Psalms he has penned. Take Psalm 13. How long, Lord, will you forget me forever? How long will you hide your face from me? How long must I wrestle with my thoughts and day after day have sorrow in my heart? Or Psalm 55. My heart is in anguish within me. The terrors of death have fallen on me. Fear and trembling have beset me. Horror has overwhelmed me. Anxiety and depression are very much thought of as modern illnesses, but it's clear from these words that David suffered them, and not in isolated incidents some 3,000 years ago. David knows life is no holiday. So how then can he pen these words in Psalm 139? How can he believe that God has authored the days of his life when they are filled with dread and terror? Was David just having a good, rare day among many bad ones? For this, we need to look at verses 17 and 18 and move into the second half of our talk. Why does David write what he writes? Why does he believe what he believes in the beauty of his creation and the beauty of his life, despite everything his circumstances and the world is telling him? Again, I've broken the section into two parts. Firstly, David's confidence is in God, and David's God is not a small God. He is vast and he is powerful. Verse 17. How precious to me are your thoughts, God. How vast is the sum of them. Were I to count them, they would outnumber the grains of sand. Does anyone know how many grains of sand there are on earth? A quick Google search, which usually gives you the answer to everything, reveals that scientists estimate there to be 7.5 sextillion grains of sand on Earth. That's 75 followed by 17 zeros. Now that is a number that doesn't really mean anything to me. It's just a number that I can't visualise, but it does seem to be the scale that God deals on. There are approximately 206 trillion stars in the universe. David is telling us that God is way beyond and way bigger than our thinking. God's thoughts are way beyond anything our tiny minds can ever comprehend. He has more than enough room to think about each and every one of us, and we have each been individually on his mind since even before we were conceived, since before the creation of the universe. David is telling us that one of the key things to being content with our lives is to realise our place, to recognise just how small each one of us is compared to the absolute majesty and magnificence of God. My dissatisfaction with my body and my circumstances is therefore more likely to grip me when I reverse or I distort this view, when God becomes small as a result of me being big, when I am God and he is my servant. And that's the very essence of sin, me getting angry with God when he hasn't made me the way that I wanted him to, or given me the life I wanted, when I use God as a means to my end rather than him being my end. So what does God say to us when we react like this, as we all do? This is what God says to Job, who was a man who had hitherto believed in the goodness and sovereignty of God, but seen that faith wither when he lost everything. And this is a bit of a long reading, but God's words are better than mine. This is from Job 38. Where were you when I laid the earth's foundation? Tell me if you understand. Who marked off its dimensions? Surely you know. Who stretched a measuring line across it? On what were its footing set? Or who laid its cornerstone? While the morning stars sang together and all the angels shouted for joy. Who shut up the sea behind the doors when it burst forth from the womb? When I made the clouds its garment and wrapped it in thick darkness? When I fixed limits for it and set its doors and bars in place? When I said, this far you may come and no farther, here is where you proud waves halt. Have you journeyed to the springs of the sea or walked into the recesses of the deep? Have the gates of death been shown to you? Have you seen the gates of the deepest darkness? Have you comprehended the vast expanses of the earth? Tell me if you know all this. Can you bind the chains of the Pleiades? Can you loosen Orion's belt? Can you bring forth the constellations in their seasons? Or lead out the bear with its cubs? Do you know the laws of the heavens? Can you set up God's dominion over earth? Who provides food for the raven when its young cry out to God and wander about for lack of food? Does that not tell us our place? Does that not tell us that God knows everything and he knows it's not perfect? And does it not tell us the true size and scales of God, and he cares about the small things in life, like the tiny raven, as well as those on a cosmic scale, such as the movement of the stars and the galaxies? And does it not tell us, no matter how awful things may seem, or how powerful the forces on earth may be against us, he is in control? No matter what our circumstances, when God is big and we are small, we can see just how much he loves us, no matter what suffering we may be going through. Unfortunately, all of us have a distorted view of ourselves and God, where we inflate or substitute ourselves into God's position. A growing faith is not about us becoming better people, but one in which God is growing in size and our own self-importance is diminishing. If we think it's all about us and what we do, then our faith is not really growing. We're just modifying our behaviour. We're trying to win God's favour so he will make our circumstances better. We are using God as a means to an end rather than give him his place as our chief end. I think that's why God has given us the Psalms. If your God feels small, read the Psalms. They will let you know the power of God. So why else does David believe what he believes? Secondly, and finally, look again at the last few words of verse 18. And they're hidden away there. When I awake, I am still with you. David not only knows who God is and his power, he knows him personally. He knows his presence. David knows that God is with him, and that's why he's able to rejoice and write about God's wonder and splendor, no matter what is going on in his body or his life. I think these words are the key to not only our passage today, but also the entire psalm and indeed the Bible. Nothing makes sense if we do not have a personal encounter with God and a taste of his presence. Let me take you to Mark's Gospel now, chapter 4, verse 35, where the whole message of today plays out in real life and where all the parties would have been familiar with Psalm 139. That day, when evening came, Jesus said to his disciples, "Let us go over to the other side." Leaving the crowd behind, they took him along just as he was in the boat. There were also other boats with him. A furious squall came up and the waves broke over the boat so that it was nearly swamped. Jesus was in the stern, sleeping on a cushion. For the disciples, life had gotten out of control. They had moved from dry land, where they were in control of their own lives, and onto a tiny boat heading through a terrible storm. Now, these are highly experienced fishermen, and they know they shouldn't be there. They're in huge peril, and they panic. David's words in Psalm 139 cannot be further from their minds as the waves wash up over the boat. They are sinking. They have no belief in a powerful or present God who has made them and authored their days. But Jesus doesn't panic. Like David, he can sleep through the storms. Even at his most vulnerable, Jesus knows God's calming presence and peace, and he does not worry. And let's not forget, Jesus knows what is ahead of him, the road in which he's embarked. He knows that dark days lie shortly ahead of him, where crucifixion and separation from God are his cup to drink. Yet Jesus could sleep peacefully through the storms, knowing the truths of the wonders set out in Psalm 139. Just like David, he is at peace in God's presence, despite the looming terror ahead of him. He knows who has said to the waves they are currently facing, "This far you may come, and no further. Here is where you proud waves halt." And so when Jesus calms the waves, it's pretty clear what the implications are. He is God. Like the disciples, we have Jesus' presence. God come to earth as a man is the ultimate sign of his love for us. Jesus knows life is no picnic. Remember, he asked God if it had been possible to take away the cup of death he faced, but not if it was not God's will. And he took the cup so we might make it to the other side. He faced the gates of darkness spoken in Job 38, the gates of the deepest darkness. The picture given to us in Mark's Gospel is one where we surrender control by leaving dry land and getting a boat that is heading into stormy waters, where we do not know what lies ahead and we know that we have no control. Jesus has promised to take us to the other side, and no matter what we face, he is in the boat with us, and he is not worried. Are we going to trust him? Are we going to keep going forward? Are we going to focus on the power of God and the personal presence of Jesus? Or are we going to let the size of the waves, which may be terrifying, block out the power and presence of God? And so to finish, David faced the same physical limitations and difficult circumstances, probably more so than all of us. That may have given him a convenient excuse to dismiss God, like Diana and James, but he couldn't, because he knew his power and he knew his presence. And David knew, no matter what brutality in life came his way, he could still whisper to God, "You are still with me." Can you? So let's finish in prayer. Dear God, your thoughts are vaster than the grains of sand on the earth, faster than the universe itself, and yet sometimes we live as if you are meek and powerless, or we're not there at all. Lord, please help the parts of us that think we can succeed in life ourselves without you realize just how futile that thinking is. Show us our folly and help us know as our place as a creature wonderfully created. And Lord, I earnestly pray for all those whose bodies, healths, hearts and minds have been damaged in life. Stay with us until we reach the shore, and let us see how truly knowing and being present with you dwarfs all of our suffering, no matter how horrid it is. Amen. Thank you very much.